This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A success story in the Arab Spring, Libya becomes a haven for anti-Western terrorist operations. Could the Arab Spring become a vast refuge central for al-Qaeda and al-Shabaab fighters on the run? We're going to take a look at that frightening scenario in just a moment, along with other frightening scenarios today. Some imagined by legendary American author Edgar Allan Poe. There's a new Poe exhibit right here in New York, and it's not just scary, it's a whole lot more. Is the melting Arctic, that's pretty scary, a reign of terrifying climate change or an opportunity for international cooperation? The president of Iceland joins us. How's that? And as the Supreme Court takes up its next big term, we'll do our own constitutional consideration of the shutdown shenanigans in Washington. But first, there are reports today that U.S. Navy SEAL teams raided a facility of a suspected al-Shabaab terrorist who might have been involved in the bloody Nairobi, Kenya mall attacks last month. Also, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel formally announced over the weekend that Special Operations Forces attacked a neighborhood in Tripoli, Libya, taking into custody Nazi Abdul Hamid al-Rukai, who has been a suspect in U.S.-targeted al-Qaeda operations for more than a decade and a half. We're joined by Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff. He represents California's 28th district and is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Now, for some who are very, very down in the weeds on this, Nazi Abdul Hamid al-Rukai is referred to by his sort of terrorist name as Abu Anas al-Libi. How important is he, do you think?
Well, he's very important in a couple of respects. He had a major role in the embassy bombings in the 1990s. But I also think he's important in sending a message that it may take us a long time to track you down, but we will never stop. And that that kind of perseverance, I think, is a very important part of our counterterrorism policy and lets people know they'll be held accountable. So it was a big and risky operation, a gutsy thing for the administration to do. And for those who participated in it, and glad to learn it was successful.
Now, where did you stand on the military strike against chemical weapons in Syria, Congressman Schiff?
Well, I thought that the United States should work with the international community and try to enforce this international sanction. I had a great deal of concern about our going it alone. And I think actually where we are right now is probably the best that could be imagined, that we have a UN organized process of dismantling and destroying that chemical weapons infrastructure. So I think it was certainly a rocky start and a uncertain course that got us here, but the fact that these chemical weapons can be taken off the battlefield now and in the future is a unmitigated positive.
All right, now I'm not trying to play Mr. Debater here or put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me like you were opposed to a military strike on the basis of chemical weapons in Syria, but apparently you have no problem with boots on the ground in Tripoli, Libya, or in Somalia?
Well, I think that targeted counterterrorism operations are not only appropriate but very necessary. And here, you know, where the alternative is using drones that can potentially involve loss of civilian life, it's a tough decision to make because it puts our own people's lives at risk. But happily, in both occasions, we had no casualties. And with the successful operation in Libya, we now have the intelligence value that can be gained from interrogating the suspect, as well as the possibility of bringing about justice for those who were the victims of those two bombings.
Would you describe this as an extraordinary rendition, precisely the same kind of capturing of a suspect that went on during the Bush administration?
Well, you know, it's certainly extraordinary. It differs in significant respects, though. This suspect is not going to be brought to a black site. There's going to be no use of anything approaching torture. So I think it's very significant that the practices under the last administration have been cut off very sharply. Nonetheless, we will gain intelligence value from the interviews and interrogations that go on and the ability to try and prosecute them and uphold our system of justice. I think will be very significant as well and a strong departure from the past practices.
In general, are you satisfied with the level of pre-approval that the president has right now on operations of this kind? It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of congressional authorization here, although you were briefed on this operation, yes?
Well, we haven't been briefed on it yet. I mean, they keep these operations very close to the vest, and I imagine we'll be briefed on it tomorrow. We were out of session over the last 24 to 30 hours when the operation took place. But I imagine that we'll get a full briefing on it. You know, it's a tough call. Obviously, in order to make sure that operationally nothing is tipped, they really need to keep this very close. It's possible that they apprised the chair and ranking member of both intelligence committees, but in an operation this sensitive, that may not have even taken place until after the fact.
Let's shift to the government shutdown a little bit, which I imagine is just as frustrating to you as it is to some of your colleagues. I'm wondering, you know, the president has made some noise that he will continue to run certain aspects of the government. Chuck Hagel is calling back employees to the Pentagon. I'm wondering if there's a scenario here where the president can just commander-in-chief this out of the way, bring the National Guard to open Yosemite National Park, for instance, and just bypass the whole thing altogether.
I don't think so. You know, the president has used the authority of his office in many areas where the Congress has proved incapable of acting. You know, on the issue of gun safety, for example, and Congress proved it wouldn't take action in the wake of all these shootings. The administration did, and that's been, unfortunately, a very common scenario. But here, there's no substitute for the Congress doing its work and reopening the government. As a legal matter, I think he'd be on very skeptical footing, precarious footing, to send in the Guard or reopen in violation of the law pertaining to government shutdowns. And you know, those that are clamoring for the repeal of Obamacare and are willing to take us over the cliff of defaulting on our debt would be the first to sound the alarm of impeachment should the president do anything that they considered in violation of the rules on government shutdown.
Finally, how close to the bone are we on intelligence operations? Is there a scenario you could envision where some intelligence operative was in a safe house, needed to be moved, needed to be paid, and they had to be told, sorry, government shutdown, you're just going to have to stay there, and boom, maybe we lose that asset as a result, Congressman Schiff?
Well, you know, whenever you have furloughed 70% of the civilian workforce, there are going to be real repercussions. I would hope in a scenario like the one you described that the agencies would decide that that was essential to protect life and property. So I think those kind of situations are probably covered, but it may mean that we're taking our eyes off of other less imminent threats. It may be we're putting less of a focus on Russia and China, things that aren't, you know, imminently likely to present a threat to person and property. But nonetheless, you know, given the dangers of cyber theft and cyber intrusion, we pay a real cost if we take our eye off the ball. So absolutely going to be operational impacts. But I would hope that the agencies liberally interpret the risks to life and property such that those core areas are covered.
Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff represents California's 28th district and is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we should check in on the situation in Washington concerning the federal government closed for business.
There's a majority in Congress right now that would vote to reopen the government. They just need to bring it up for a vote.
That's where we stood last week, but that's Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, essential federal employee, speaking yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press. Joining us now is essential employee for The Takeaway, Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
Where do we stand on this Monday?
Well, shutdown enters its second week, and we stand pretty much where we have all week, except for a couple of things. John, what has happened now? Everything that you've heard about the government shutdown is no longer just about the shutdown. Here's the reality in the Capitol. The CR, the continuing resolution, the shutdown fight, has now really melded into the fight over the debt ceiling and raising the debt ceiling, despite the efforts of some members of Congress to keep those two things separate, to say, no, let's have one negotiation over raising, over opening the government and another negotiation over raising that debt ceiling. The reality is that October 17th is the deadline for the debt limit, and those two things are now becoming one big talk. I shouldn't say talk. There are no real talks going on right now, but over the weekend, you played a cut from Jack Lew there. Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, John, was not the only important person in this scenario who was making the rounds on the Sunday talk shows. Listen to John Boehner here, because what he had to say raised a lot of eyebrows around Washington and sort of puts a big question mark over where we're headed. Listen to Boehner.
There's no way we're going to pass when the votes are not in the House to pass a clean debt limit. And the president is risking default by not having a conversation with us.
That was John, on ABC's This Week. John Boehner, what is he saying there?
Okay. John Boehner was reported in the New York Times this past week of going behind the scenes and telling House Republicans basically this. Yeah, we're demanding concessions from the president on the debt ceiling, but look, there's no way I'm going to let us default. If it comes to it, I'm going to turn to the Democrats for votes. I'm not going to let us default. Boehner's staff made sure that that story got out to reporters, and it was widely interpreted as John Boehner reassuring Wall Street. Look, we may be having a political squabble, but I'm not going to let us blow through the debt ceiling. Bond prices and interest rates won't be in trouble. Don't worry. Then he goes back on television and says, we don't have the votes in the House to raise a clean debt limit, and it's not going to happen without a negotiation, a bit of will he, won't he, coming from John Boehner.
We just call it lying. It's lying. He's lying. He either had the votes or he didn't have the votes. I mean, what's going on here? We got to get down to actually talking about what's going on
and
here,
John,
at some point.
And we don't know he has the votes until he puts it on the floor, and that's the frustration from Democrats, is that they have turned around and said, if you're not lying, then put it on the floor and let's find out. Democrats say this is a negotiating tactic. He knows it would pass, the same as the CR. But here's the even bigger thing, John. Whether or not that statement from the speaker is just a negotiating tactic or whether he's actually saying, I'm going to go to the mat on this. Republicans coming out of the House conference have been telling reporters something else, that John Boehner is actually quietly pursuing something along the lines of the grand bargain. You can call it a mini grand bargain, saying to the White House, and these talks have not officially taken place yet, saying to the White House that, look, in exchange for opening up the government and raising the debt ceiling, let's talk about changing the way Medicare is calculated. Let's talk about changing the way Social Security is calculated. Let's use the money to turn off the sequester. And let's all get a win here. We don't know how real that is. And Democrats are saying we can have those discussions, but turn on the government and raise the debt ceiling first so that the president isn't seen as negotiating over things he said he would never negotiate over. And that is where we are.
Which still doesn't prevent an up or down vote on the House floor. We'll get into whether the Hastert rule, which is what's being evoked here to prevent an up or down vote, has any sort of constitutional standing at all. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Pleasure, John.
Exactly 5 years ago, at the very beginning of the financial crisis, the credit bubble burst in Iceland. Its major banks went into receivership. The nation was the canary in the coal mine of a financial explosion that went worldwide. Iceland's economy is back today. The wounds are healing. But it's possible that Iceland also holds the canary bird seat in another crisis, the warming of the climate and the transformation of the Arctic. Ólafur Gramson, the president of Iceland, decided to launch this month the first international gathering on the Arctic called Arctic Circle. When President Gramson recently visited our studios, he said that the U.S. ignores the Arctic's changes, its commercial values, and its strategic importance at our peril.
Since I have always been honest with my American friends, the U.S. could be more engaged, could be more involved. You should move the Arctic higher up on the U.S. agenda. You have been somewhat otherwise engaged in the last 10 or 15 years. And why should you be more engaged? Well, first of all, the Arctic is America's backyard. It is one of the most resource-rich areas in the world. So if America wants to continue to be a big economy in the 21st century, American companies, the American economy has to have a strong Arctic dimension. And now we have a situation after the decision in May by the Arctic Council that 11 of the biggest economies in the world, Asian and European, as well as the U.S. and the Russians, are sitting at the Arctic table in one way or another. So for the first time in U.S. history, the leaders of China, South Korea, Singapore, India, France, Germany, the United Kingdom will want to talk about the Arctic with the U.S. president. And that is why I spent a lot of time last April in Washington talking to people on the Hill, in the Senate, and elsewhere, that in the scale of political priorities within the U.S., the Arctic has to move up front because this is America's backyard, and what will happen in the Arctic will determine not only America's strategic position, but also determine America's economic position. And in addition to that, there's another element, which I think very few people in the U.S. have realized so far. And it is the relevance of the Arctic for your homeland security system. You have spent a lot of effort on your homeland security. But the hidden assumption of that system in the last 10 years has been that the ice is not going to melt. But now the ice is melting. So up in Alaska at the U.S. Arctic border, you have for 2 or 3 or 4 months in the summer a completely open border where anybody on a boat can enter the U.S. without being checked in any way whatsoever. So suddenly in the U.S. Arctic, people, whether they are drug barons or whether they are foreigners, can play around and enter the U.S. Without anybody asking for your passport or checking you in any way. Like, for example, last year there was a big group of German tourists there. They went ashore, they did their shopping. The next Homeland Security official was over 1,000 miles away.
Mm. Are the Russians winning right now, both with their interest in the Arctic, their real estate holdings up there? They certainly have the greatest land mass and their huge oil reserves.
Well, 10 years ago, when I started to be very active in the Arctic discussion, there was this question about Russia. How would it perform? What would be their intentions? What are the hidden motives? But I have to tell you very honestly, and I have been having a lot of discussions of participation with the Russian leadership, both Putin and Medvedev and many other Russian players. Russia has been very constructive in the Arctic. Putin has taken a very strong personal interest in the Arctic. And they have solved their disputes with Norway. They have negotiated the oil spills agreement with the other Arctic countries. They have negotiated the search and rescue agreement. And it is a very strong lesson in optimism, in fact, to analyze without prejudice how constructive Russia has been in the Arctic cooperation. Of course, they have their interest, they have their agenda and so on. But Russia is not the problem in the Arctic in the way that that many people think. I think the biggest challenge, much more bigger than Russia, will be when all these big Asian economies will start sending their cargo vessels and this huge traffic, and the big Asian companies will want to get access to the resources in the Arctic. How are we going to deal with that? That is a much more open game than the Russian participation in the Arctic, because Russia has proved that they respect the law of the sea, they respect the legal framework, and they want to negotiate constructively further agreements.
Two things before we go. One, given the banking difficulty that Iceland had some years ago, is the economic infrastructure strong enough in Iceland to prevent a catastrophe that might threaten all of the optimism that you have about the development and growth in the Arctic?
Well, first of all, the most important lesson of the financial crisis, not just for us, but for the U.S., from Western Europe, and perhaps the global economy, is there are no guarantees. There are uncertainties. There are going to be surprises. But we have recovered more than any other country that suffered such a crisis. So we enter this future of Arctic cooperation with some important lessons that will be with us for a long time. But we also realize that given the enormity of the Arctic possibilities in terms of resources, economic activity, and science and research, we will always be a small player. So, but in order to facilitate how to bring the others together and create the harmony, you might need the participation of a country of the size and the culture of Iceland.
And you've got the best geothermal hot water in the region by far, Professor.
Well, let me just mention this to you, because a lot of people have this image of the Arctic and the energy that's all about oil and gas. Very few have realized that paradoxically, the Arctic region is one of the best examples of successful clean energy development. Not only Iceland, but also Norway, also Greenland, and many other parts of the Arctic. So you have within the Arctic cooperation fascinating examples of successful clean energy projects and developments. And that is an aspect I emphasize very strongly, because too much in the media here and elsewhere is this image of the Arctic is only about oil and gas.
President Grimson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
His Excellency Olafur Ragnar Grimmison is President of Iceland, who spoke with us recently.
Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still of bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate, yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me, truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore, quoth the raven, nevermore.
And, of course, nevermore became evermore. The Raven, that version there by Christopher Walken, one of many, is one of the classics in American poetry. And Edgar Allan Poe's masterful genius even anoints a team in the NFL, the Ravens, from Baltimore, where Poe was found dead back in the 1800s. But his journey from Richmond, Virginia, to the hotbed New York literary scene, poverty, despair, and finally immortality, is a classic American story all by itself. Poe was responsible for far more than his creepy stories and poems. He helped to create a fully independent American literary voice, paving the way for William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, Toni Morrison, Joseph Heller, many, many, many more. Dr. Isaac Gewirtz co-curated a new show on Poe's real influence for the Morgan Library here in New York City. He joins me now. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you. Good day.
It's so fascinating to think about Poe because he is so vast, from the scary stories to literary criticism to his very serious novelistic works. He is a figure like no other.
He is. And this is what my co-curator, Dr. Declan Kiley, who's curator of literary and historical manuscripts at the Morgan, tried to bring out. We were so impressed by the breadth of his achievement that we wanted to bring selections of those to the general public. And because we had three collections to choose from, three excellent collections, we were able to do that.
And while this is an exhibit in October and roughly coincides with Halloween, this goes way beyond simply ghost stories, right?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, the whole question about whether or not Poe really wrote ghost stories is one which has challenged readers and critics and scholars since their inception. There were two kinds of Gothic. One is the so-called explained, and one is the Gothic that actually purports and does bring in the supernatural. And Poe was very much of the former, of the explained Gothic, the English tradition. What was fascinating to me in getting into Poe was that he adopted different narrative personas for different kinds of story. And there are styles that correspond to each. So he has the British aristocrat, he has the European aristocrat, and then he has the American.
And he loves to pillory the British aristocrat. Here's an excerpt from a review by a set of poems of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Even if the construction of her sentence be understood as implying that the fiery seeds were sown, not immediately by the steep generations that tumbled down the stairs, but immediately through the intervention of the supernatural thunders that were occasioned by the steep generations that were so unlucky as to tumble down the stairs. Now, you have to read the poem to totally understand, but he is absolutely trashing her poetry, using her exact words, and accusing her of being a drunk tumbling down the stairs.
It's interesting about Barrett Browning because in other places he does review her rather favorably. As a matter of fact, she thanked him for that.
That's amazing. Some of the rarest pieces in American literary history are to be found in this exhibit. Give me a sense.
One extraordinary group of items are the three copies of Tamerlane and Other Poems. This is the first published work by Poe, published in 1827. His name is not on it. It says by a Bostonian. There are only 12 known copies in existence. The Berg has two.
Wow.
Susan Jaffe Tane had one and graciously loaned it to the exhibition. And so now you can see three together, which probably hasn't been the case since they came off the press.
Isaac Gortz is co-curator of the Morgan Library exhibit right here in New York, Edgar Allan Poe, Terror of the Soul, and he's curator of the Henry W. and Albert A. Berg Collection of English and American Literature at the New York Public Library, where some of the Morgan exhibit actually comes from. Isaac, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Not even a divided Congress can stop the U.S. Supreme Court, although some of the carpeting in the Supreme Court building may be a little dustier due to the shutdown. The 2013-2014 term begins today. We turn now to Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent for the National Law Journal. Marcia, welcome.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you.
So it seems as though separation of powers is the order of the day with all of this business going on in Washington. Does the court look at issues like this in this term? What do we see coming up?
Oh, this is going to be potentially a really big term, John. You know, in the last two terms, we focused on one or two big cases. For example, health care two terms ago, and last term, same-sex marriage was the big one. But this term, there are at least 10 issues before the court that we would call hot-button issues, issues like abortion, separation of church and state, affirmative action, and even separation of powers involving President Obama's recess appointment power. So it's going to be potentially a very important term, and I think we're going to learn a lot about the Roberts Court.
Let's take campaign finance first. Will this be the term where the court finally does spell out money equals speech?
It could well be. I think we're going to have to see if the court wants to take baby steps when it comes to limits on contributions. As you remember, in Citizens United, they lifted federal limits on independent spending by corporations and unions. But they've never really touched federal limits on individual contributions to candidates and political parties. It's sort of been sacrosanct. But we'll have to wait and see if they are ready to do that. I think there may be at least three votes. And it's going to really come down, I think, to Chief Justice Roberts in terms of whether he wants to go down this road or whether he wants to go fast or slow.
The court could enshrine government prayer as a possibility in that a sort of free speech issue, and prayer is going to be a very important issue before the court. Also, this could be the end of affirmative action as we know it, right?
That's right. The prayer case is fascinating. This could be a big term for religion in general. The court is revisiting the area of government accommodation of prayer in a case out of New York, the town of Greece. Most of the prayers offered at the opening of their town board meetings have been predominantly Christian in nature. The court's going to look again at a 1983 ruling in which it upheld legislative prayers. And affirmative action is back again in a very different way. Instead of a challenge to the use of affirmative action, there's a challenge to the state of Michigan's ban on affirmative action in higher education.
So what about abortion? Is this going to be a comprehensive case, or is it going to be a small piece of the entire abortion debate that the court takes up?
It could be either. There are actually two abortion cases on the docket. One involves a 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics in Massachusetts, and the other one that I think offers the bigger potential for a big ruling is a case out of Oklahoma. The state law there regulates the use of drugs that are used to terminate a pregnancy, drugs like RU486. That case is in an iffy position right now because the court asked the Oklahoma Supreme Court to clarify the meaning of the law. But I know from the groups supporting the state law that they hope that this might be the undoing of Justice O'Connor's decision in the Planned Parenthood versus Casey case.
Finally, you mentioned the recess appointments of the president and the court deciding to take up this question of recess appointments. Given all the parliamentary trickery that's going on between Congress and the White House, I'm wondering if the Supreme Court is really aggressively interested in limiting White House power by taking this NLRB versus Cannon case.
Well, I think they really had no choice but to take it. And this is going to be really interesting, John, because there's not a whole lot written about the meaning of the recess appointments clause. So the court's really going to have to do some research into the history of that clause as well as the actual language of it. And you're right. This is a big case because there are hundreds of National Labor Relations Board decisions that hang in the balance here. And it could also affect recess appointments in other areas as well.
Marcia Coyle is chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. On the first Monday of October, beginning of the 2013-2014 Supreme Court term. Thanks, Marcia.
My pleasure, John. Take care.
Let's say on this first Monday of October, I am a law clerk to one of the Supreme Court justices, and I defy the shutdown, head into work anyway. I'm interested in this Justice Alito 2011 opinion, Brown v. Entertainment Merchants, on video game violence. Alito actually went along with the majority to apply the First Amendment to violent video games, but he made a very different argument from the rest of the court. It's complicated, you know, plenty of footnotes and, internet links to support him. Here's one. Federal Trade Commission, .gov. That can't be working. But it is. Nice. Here's one, slashgear.com. Justice Alito on SlashGear. Does he have an Xbox or a PS3 in his office? Working. Huh. All about 3D capability coming down the pike. Then he says, check out these realistic kill scenes from the Spike TV Video Game Awards. Highly realistic graphics. This is what Justice Alito says the majority missed and why he might consider restrictions in the future. Here's the crucial piece of information and the link. Error. Broken. Nowhere. This is a huge problem, it turns out. According to a Harvard University study, 49% of the internet links cited in recent Supreme Court decisions lead absolutely nowhere, or some even show signs of having been hacked. Jonathan Zittrain, co-founder of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and author of the study, says the Supreme Court's ability to maintain its information citations of online sources has not kept pace with its hunger to use the internet in writing its opinions.
Well, as you might guess, the reliance has been growing from the moment that the Supreme Court first linked to a website in 1995 or so. And I think it's because both in legal scholarship and in legal opinions, oftentimes they're relying on sources, either as examples of something or as actual sources of argument, that cross lots of boundaries of disciplines or that go out to the public web. So we see now quite typically link after link in papers where the link is the source. It's not just a place you can find that New York Times article. It is a website or a blog entry that without it, you wouldn't have the source.
And this dysfunction of the hyperlinks on the Supreme Court site is really in some ways about a clash of metaphors of legal information, the dusty old law library that sort of sits relatively inanimate, and the online database, which requires constant management and updating. The collision of those two has produced this sense of complexity that looks like it's outrun the Supreme Court.
Yes, and it's interesting that libraries were developed to deal with the problem of scarcity and integrity of resources. It was hard to get a particular book, so we'll get one and keep it well indexed and be able to lend it to anybody who needs it and then save it for the next person too. That was sort of how the physical library worked before. It would seem at first glance that the development of the open web really supplants that because everything is just a click away and you don't need to borrow your copy. You can just make a copy when you need it. The only problem is that that works until it doesn't. And because the web is wonderfully distributed, it means that where I click on a link to visit something, who knows what that server does at 10 o'clock at night or where it's been or how long it'll be around. And our study shows that over time, links, even to government sites and things that you might think would be more permanent, they stop working. And all you have is just click here to see what we mean, and then you click and you don't see anything useful.
Now, how do you think the dysfunction of hyperlinks on the Supreme Court website affects the preparation of briefs, the development and maintenance of legal scholarship?
Well, at the moment, the use of those links and then the decay that they experience, I think no one owns that problem. If you're the court, you just publish the link, it works, and it's just up to you to say, well, the last time we tried it, it worked. And if you're writing a brief, as long as it works for the moment that the judges contemplate it, you also might be happy. So I think there's a real role for universities and libraries to play to take a longer view and make it so that the products of our courts that become part of the law of the land and of legal scholarship and perhaps later scholarship more generally are preserved for the ages at least as well as they were in the era in which libraries kept custody of physical documents.
I mean, in a sense, this problem is crucial because even though a judge can create a citation and a link in an opinion in 2013 and it'll work for a little while, the idea that it vanishes or doesn't work, you know, a month from now or even 3 years from now, because we so depend on precedent to develop laws and opinions, it would be as though, you know, somebody references the Federalist Papers and you go to the library, oh, yeah, we threw those out. Sorry. I mean, it creates a huge vacuum in the law.
Yes, that's right. The idea that if you then click and you can't even see the example, it really not only undermines the authority of the opinion because you can't actually follow the link and see, but it makes it harder to take whatever the reasoning of the opinion is and apply it.
All right. So your study found 49%. You're sticking with that number, 49%?
49.9 of the opinions from 1995 to 2012. If you just lop off the most recent year, and you imagine there's where the links would be fresher and less likely to rot, that number starts to go higher and higher. Just by taking off the last 2 years, the average will jump from 50% rounded up to as close as 70%.
Wow. All right. So to deal with this, the circuit in San Francisco has tried to develop a database where the links always connect with some PDF document as opposed to a link simply to a server or some other website. Is that a solution as far as you can tell?
Well, it's a great start. And we've been working on a more comprehensive solution that involves now about 30 libraries coming together around the world that will make it so that if you are writing or editing a piece of scholarship or a legal opinion, you can take a link that you're about to pop into the opinion and that is likely to rot within a couple years and hand it to one of those libraries, which will archive it in several different flexible formats. And then that library, along with the other libraries, will preserve it indefinitely and hand back a link to the system, which is called perma.cc. So the perma system would contain that stuff forever, and you put the perma link into your opinion or piece of scholarship. And if people click on it, they will have a chance to see the original link. But if that doesn't work, they'll have an opportunity to see the archive that the author saw and found worthy of preservation.
Jonathan Zittrain, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Zittrain is a professor of law and computer science at Harvard, co-founder of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and is co-author of this current study.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now, speaking from the bench, Justice Jay Carney of the U.S. Court of Public Opinion.
The Constitution gives Congress, not the President, the authority to borrow money, and only Congress can increase the debt ceiling, which is why it's time that they do their job and raise the debt ceiling.
That's White House Press Secretary, of course, Jay Carney, just one of the self-appointed justices of the courts of public opinion in the U.S., trying to blame, argue, or problem-solve our way out of the shutdown crisis, invoking at every stage what the American people want. We've been looking at this shutdown crisis from a number of legal perspectives over the last week or so. Joining me now is Michael C. Dorff, law professor at Cornell University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
First of all, is it as clear-cut as Jay Carney says, the Constitution gives Congress total authority over this debt ceiling and the running of the government?
Yes and no. It is clear-cut that Congress has the authority to borrow money, and the president can't borrow money without congressional authorization. But it's also true that Congress has the authority to set the level of taxation and the level of spending. And so the assumption that the Obama administration and other people have been acting upon, that is that if we pass the debt ceiling, it's up to the president to cut spending, is equally problematic, because that's Congress's job also. So anything the president does after October 17th, if Congress hasn't acted, will mean the president is acting in a way that usurps congressional power, because he has no choice.
Do you think that there is a presidential commander-in-chief way out of this? Could you call out the National Guard and reopen the government, for instance? The 14th Amendment references the national debt on some level. Can the president use that to reassert his authority?
I don't think so. That is to say, I don't believe that there's anything the president could do that would be lawful. My view, which I've expressed in a number of scholarly articles with a friend of mine and colleague, Neil Buchanan, is that when the president is placed in a position where all of his actions are unconstitutional, including doing nothing, his job is to choose the least unconstitutional action. That would mean, I think, issuing debt without Congress's authorization, which, I want to be clear, is a terrible position to be in and a terrible thing to do. And that doesn't solve the problem, but it mitigates the harm better than any of the other options.
So basically, under this least unconstitutional Dorf doctrine here, under the 14th Amendment, the president, if given no other choice, could go ahead and issue the debt.
Well, it's not exactly the 14th Amendment that's doing the work. The 14th Amendment says that it's unconstitutional to question the validity of the public debt. So it may well be that failure to raise the debt ceiling violates the 14th Amendment. But as a number of people have pointed out, it doesn't logically follow that the president can therefore do whatever he wants or borrow money. So it would still be unconstitutional for the president to borrow that money, but as you said, just less unconstitutional than doing the other things. So the 14th Amendment is not a magic bullet. It's part of the system of checks that there are on the president and Congress that it looks like are all breaking down.
Magic bullet, huh? Yes, we all yearn for some sort of literary solution here. We're talking with Professor Michael Dorf at Cornell Law School. Help me out with something here. John Boehner, who ostensibly has the votes to restart the government in a majority in the House of Representatives, you follow me?
Yep.
Is evoking some parliamentary rule. Actually, it's a subset of a parliamentary rule. It's called the Hastert Rule, which basically says no bill will be brought to the floor without a majority of Republicans backing it in the Republican caucus. Has there ever been a test of parliamentary law, silly old Robert's Rules of Order, parliamentary law, basically getting into the way of the Constitution of the United States? That's what's happening here, right?
Yeah, that's a great question. The debate about this question usually focuses on the cloture rule, which is the rule in the Senate that says you need 60 votes to end debate. And it's what permits a minority of senators to filibuster, or under the current system, just to say they're filibustering and prevent majority rule. And a number of people say that's unconstitutional because the Constitution only requires a majority vote for each House of Congress. No court case has ever challenged that, nor has a court case ever challenged similar rules like the Hastert rule in a House of Representatives. And I think the reason is because the Constitution also says that each House of Congress can make its own rules. And so rules of procedure are considered permissible, even they have the effect of denying majority rule. So I should be clear, I think that the cloture rule and the Hastert rule, so-called Hastert rule, because it's not really a rule, but procedures like this are very bad for democracy. But I think it's very unlikely that the courts would say that Congress or the respective houses of Congress lack the authority to implement them.
All right. But then as a law professor, then does this call for some sort of amendment to the Constitution, which basically says whatever the rules in the House and Senate, no rule shall be passed, thereby allowing one bonehead, and we probably wouldn't use the word bonehead, to shut everything in the government and in the financial world down, right?
Well, there actually – You actually need a constitutional amendment to do that. At the beginning of each session of Congress, the rules are up for grabs and can be changed by a simple majority. You may recall at the beginning of the current Congress, there was some negotiation between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell over in the Senate about whether to change the cloture rule. And ultimately, they made a few small cosmetic changes, but left it basically as it is. Over in the House, there's the possibility of a so-called discharge petition, whereby a majority of the members can overrule the Speaker's nomination not to bring a bill to the floor. And there's talk that Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is trying to get some Republicans to join with the Democrats in the House to do that. So I think there are mechanisms available by which ordinary majority rule can reassert itself, even without a constitutional amendment.
That's great stuff. Great stuff. Michael C. Dorff is the Robert S. Stevens Professor of Law at Cornell Law School. Professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Day 7, government shutdown, no end in sight. We're in Act 2 at best here in a grand Shakespearean drama. Okay, maybe it's a comedy or a history. Bill isn't available to us, of course, so for an ending, how about Dave in New York?
So, friends, let this be known that we who made the noise do now the silence own.
Ooh, Dave actually wrote that, but we are relying on our good friend from WQXR, radio announcer, performer Jeff Spurgeon. From St. Peter's, Missouri?
An ideology with no alternative. An end to governing is what they sought. Complete obedience was their imperative. But chaos and disdain was what they got.
Magnificent. End this thing, Francie from California.
After the slaughter, the powerful feasted and wished each other, their previous foes, a hail and hearty holiday season, and to hell with the common man.
I like that one. I like that one. But wait, wait, wait. Act 5, Anoka, Minnesota, last line.
It mattered not. The people watched football instead of caring.
Thanks to Jeffrey Spurgeon, of course. Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome, John.
Your final lines, your final thoughts, all welcome. 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet them at The Takeaway. Tomorrow, our apocalyptic theme continues. Jad Abumrad from Radiolab joins us from Detroit to talk about the ending of things and how you do that on radio and on stage. This is how we end. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.